Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 867. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Whether you need a portfolio, or you want to sell products and or services, or you just want a blog, you just want a longer blog than basic bite-sized social media can provide for you, Squarespace gives you everything you need to make your next move into a reality, including a free domain. And not to mention, with Squarespace beautifully designed templates and customizable features, you can create a beautiful website that is simple and intuitive, and you can just add and arrange your content with the click of a mouse. So start a free trial today. Squarespace.com, enter the offer code Nerdist to get 10% off your first purchase. Now let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. First of all, the ID10T Festival, ID10TFest.com, is a festival that I created to essentially try to make a music comedy festival, but with also kind of a Comic-Con at the center of it. So maybe you already know about it, maybe you don't. Go to ID10TFest.com. Weezer is playing. TV on the Radio, OK Go, Car Seat Headrest, Tank and the Bangas. Also, there's comedy stages with Brian Posehn, Garfunkel and Oates, Michael Che, Dimitri Martin, Yasser Lester, Brent Weinbach. Then there's an EDM cosplay tent, and then a whole comic book creators. There's going to be panels, there's going to be podcasts. So there'll be something to do all day long. Nothing really crashes into one another. It's just all day long stuff to do. So that's June 24, 25 in Mountain View at the Shoreline Amphitheater. So please come to that. Get tickets. Come. Also, Tony writes, I've been listening to the podcast for the last 3 years, and it's helped me through some hard times when I was trying to get my show, Graham Cracker, up in Chicago. I've been working on some version of the show for the past 18 years, and we have one weekend left, April 28 through 30. The show is a blend of theater and film, and the cast is doing an amazing job. Graham Cracker explores the meaning of family, heritage, and identity through the lens of a young man faced with his last chance to see his estranged father again. To purchase tickets, go to bspfilm.com/GC. Which I assume stands for Graham Cracker. I'm going to guess. I'm going to go out on a limb. Or it stands for K-K-K. Listen to this business. Jonah Carey, who does a podcast on the Nerdist Network, Jonah Carey's podcast, who is great. I've done his podcast. He's had a lot of sports people on. I'm not a sports person, obviously, but he's had a lot of sports people on. But he's just a great talker and a really nice guy. Jonah Carey, who's Canadian, got Justin Trudeau, Canadian Prime Minister, in his first podcast appearance. They talk about Montreal Expos. They talk about running a country and more. So go to nerds.com and on iTunes and look for Jonah Carey's podcast. That's K-E-R-I. And there you go. This episode is Dave Gahan of Depeche Mode. Depeche Mode is one of my favorite bands. And I met Dave at K-Rock a handful of months ago. And I guess probably a year. Now a year has become a handful of months ago. It's probably a year ago. And he was like, hey, I love At Midnight. And I'm like, how do you know that? I know who you are. You're not supposed to know who I am. And that time I said, hey, you should come on the podcast sometime. And it happened. The Depeche Mode is about to do another huge tour around their new album, Spirit. And the tour starts in a few weeks and is all over the world. Go to DepecheMode.com for tickets and info. But Dave is such a open, warm, wonderful guy. I mean, it's like you talk to him and you don't get the sense like, oh, this guy's the front man for one of the biggest bands in the history of music. But he was just so lovely to talk to. And I had one of my best friends, April Richardson, sit in on the podcast because April is also, if I'm a big Depeche Mode fan, she's an even bigger Depeche Mode fan. And April's birthday is in a couple days. And I'm like, you know what, April? It's your birthday. You need to come meet Dave Gahan and do the podcast. So it was great to have her on, too. And it's kind of, in a way, celebrate April's birthday by hanging out with Dave Gahan. So wish April's at AP on Twitter. Wish her a happy birthday. It's in a few days. Dave Gahan of Depeche Mode. Holy shit. This episode also brought to you by Stamps.com. Listen, guys, it saves you time and money from going to the frickin' post office. Stop doing that to yourself. Mail any letter package using just your computer and your printer, and then the mail carrier picks it up. No more hassle. Stamps.com never closes. You can print any kind of postage you want for a letter or package 24/7. It's convenient, it's reliable, it's flexible, it's easy. So they're going to send you a digital scale to automatically calculate the exact postage you need. You print it out, so you're not wasting money. It's the exact thing you need in the exact way that you would need it. Right now, enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and that digital scale that I mentioned without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com, enter the promo code Nerdist. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again. Now here's the Nerdist podcast number 867 with Dave Gahan of Depeche Mode. Oh, he's so wonderful. It's so interesting. All right, Katie, please, roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Glad you're here.
Yeah, cool. So last time I saw you was a K-Rock thing.
At the K-Rock thing.
It was very early.
It was really early in the morning.
Yeah, you were there before me too.
I was. Yes, I was. Because it's so far from where I live that I leave very early in the morning, and some days I could get there really early or some days I could be late. I just don't know because of Trevor. But I worked at K-Rock in the 90s when it was in Burbank. And it was in that weird
office.
That's
right. It was in that where we used to have to go in the parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
If you drove in there and they'd announced it, there'd be a bunch of fans there and they'd drive us underneath.
You'd have to go underneath and then go up.
Yeah,
to the
thing. I never really went in the front door of that place. But yeah, they were there for a long time. And then years and years ago, it's funny because the other day I was listening to the radio, I was driving to rehearsals, and it was who used to be at K-Rock, DJ, what was her name?
What was it? Well, there was
really old. I'm talking like 30 years ago.
Oh, I don't.
She was.
It wasn't Tam.
Dusty Street. Yes.
Oh my God.
And she was on like the radio. And seriously, I was like, can that be her? Because I guess it was. She was doing like she was on like those shows of like classic vinyl. Or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. Seriously, all the K-Rock guys, all the MTV people.
But she used to be, K-Rock was like a tiny little room, like it was just above somewhere, or this little, like above a garage or something.
Oh my gosh.
And we got, same as in New York when it was like, there was like WDRE and stuff like that. You had to go out to Long Island.
Oh my God.
And do that stuff. When radio was
a thing.
Was different, wasn't it? It's sort of like, I don't know, it's different now. I'm not saying it's bad now or anything. It's just really different.
Well, there was definitely a hit machine going on in pop music, but you know, when K-Rock is like coming out of punk and Brit alt rock and like everything that we all got in the early 80s here in the States, K-Rock was
It was the one, and it was very, I guess, much more alternative.
Yes.
Then it was playing stuff that you would not hear on the radio, like on the mainstream radio at all.
Yeah.
Same as WDRE in New York. That was what they were like as well. And predominantly, that's the only places we got played.
Oh my God. Yeah, because by the time I started working at K-Rock in 95, it already had become like a hit machine. And there were playlists, and you had to stick to the playlists. And it was already very...
Yeah.
You know, but they kind of made it seem like, oh, we're just this ragtag, but it was very programmed by that point.
It seemed like I peed myself.
No, that's all right. I want you to be comfortable. If you need to pee yourself here, Dave, we're
very
among
nervous.
Friends.
Those days have gone, fortunately, we can tell some stories about waking up in various bodily fluids. It's not fun.
And hopefully most of them were yours. You don't know.
You're never quite sure.
You're never sure.
You're never quite sure because of the memory lapse. Where am I, first of all? What happened? And how did I get here?
I'm in Munich, you say?
I mean, things like that happen to me. Honestly, they really did. I'm in Amsterdam. I'm pretty sure I was in Berlin couple of days ago, is that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, even before then, just the touring musician schedule, I feel like that could happen sober anyway.
It still does anyway. I'm still like, it's the roadies, I'm like, still like, and they'll hold up, you know, Budapest.
Like, good evening, whatever.
I still have that. They actually put a big sign right on, like, where my monitors are.
Oh, that's hilarious.
You know, Bratislava.
Have you ever said the wrong city? I have. Yes, I've.
Do you
I've
get booed, definitely... or are they like, what?
No, you just get kind of looks from the front rows, like.
Just kidding.
Yeah, that's like our
but seriously,
night.
Who are you?
Yeah, but seriously,
it's great to be here. Yeah. You?
Yeah, exactly.
Sure,
yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that? You know, listen. You know, I grew up. I was born in 71, so the 80s were really my formative years. And when I think back about it now...
You're such a young man, Chris.
I mean, it doesn't feel like...
I was born in 62.
I know, but that's only nine. You're only nine years.
But that was... You know, I was lucky to be born at that time because by the time I was getting to be just my early teens, like 11, 12, music was pretty cool in England.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
we got the
time.
Pistols and the Damned and all these. But before that, of course, I had Bowie and I had T-Rex. And I had, you know, so, and then suddenly, you know, Johnny Rotten was on TV and my mum, was like, oh, he just swore. I think he said bollocks. You know, and I was like shaking, you know. It was so awesome. And just the effect it had on my mother. I was like, I'm in. That's what I'm doing this. This is what I'm doing.
Well, it totally, like, that era of, you know, because at the same time, you have this, like, British comedy explosion, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you have Python, you have all these great, that are basically just taking really button-up British culture and... Yeah. Essentially just spreading their butthole.
Yeah, I mean, Monty Python was like the thing to watch. There was a few things. There was a few shows you watched. You watched Top of the Pops. You watched the old Grey Whistle Test. And you watched Monty Python. And that was kind of it in England. Because there was only, when we only had all three channels. We had BBC One, BBC Two and ITV. And they all ended at about, like, 11:30 as well. So if you still watch it, just suddenly went to this little dot, like, and you're like, oh, that's it.
Please come back.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess we better go out and vandalize now.
Please come back. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, everything closed early in England. Like, all the bars closed. Everything closed early back then.
Everything. Nothing on Sundays. Yeah.
I was reading that you were and if you don't want to talk about any of this, please don't worry about it. We'll cut out anything you want to talk about.
I will talk about anything, Chris, if you give me a drink.
Well, when I was really kind of digging around, like, I don't really know that much about Dave's backstory, but to find out that you didn't know who your biological father was for the first handful of years of your life.
No, quite a few years. Until my stepfather died when I was 9, actually. And I think it was because I was the young... My sister was older than me, and they probably had kind of was... They tell me now that I did know this, or, like, you know, but I was too young to understand. But I definitely felt like... Because my stepfather also... My mother remarried. My father left when I was, like, 6 months or something. So my mother remarried, and then my stepfather, I thought was my dad, had two younger brothers. So Pete and Phil, my brothers. And and of course, he was very affectionate to them.
Sure.
And I was the older brother, and I kind of always felt...
How did he treat you?
He didn't treat me bad or anything. In fact, he was, you know, I only got beaten a few times, and I probably deserved it. He did take his belt off a couple of times for me, which was terrifying.
Same childhood.
Yeah.
We had literally the same childhood.
Really,
like, my dad left, and then my stepdad. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
He had two sons, and he was not cool to me.
Right.
He was super cool to them.
It wasn't... We do things like, which I knew was odd, even at a very young age. Like, my brother Pete, who was the next one down... He just stop me if I'm...
No, no, please.
No, I'm into it.
I will ramble on.
Oh, my God, I'm so bored. Hurry up.
He would, you know, have my younger brother on his lap when he came in from work. And he worked for Shell Oil probably in some terrible refinery. He died very, very young. He was only like 47 or something. So he probably was breathing some horrendous fumes. But, he would put Pete on his lap. That would be the first thing. And Pete would help him to roll one of those cigarettes that came out of the little tin box.
Oh, right.
You know, and you'd close it, and then the rolly cigarette
kind of
popped out.
You know, kids are so good at that because of their tiny hands.
And he was like five.
They can really tight
yeah,
roll.
Right?
They can
and
get
I was kind of like, you know, seven going like, why don't I get to do that? You know, I wanted to have a go at that. I could do that. And it was things like that, just little things. He would give Pete, like, them, like, half a crown, and I would get a shilling, with, you know, as pocket money. It was things like that, like that. I thought there must be something wrong with me, even at a very young age. So then when he died, there we were. He was dead. And I watched him actually take his last breath. I came downstairs and I heard my mum sort of panicking and stuff. And I woke up, came down, I looked around the door and I saw he was on the couch and my mum was like leaning up and he spluttered a bit and coughed and I guess died. And my mum turned around and saw me kind of looking. She said, "You get up to upstairs, you know." And the ambulance came. He was gone. Never saw him again. And then at the funeral, I was kind of a couple of times by a couple of uncles who were his side of the family. I was kind of like told I wasn't showing enough. I guess I wasn't upset enough or something.
How old were you?
I was like 9.
Okay.
And I honestly didn't. All I remember about that is I didn't really have any feelings about it.
There was a disconnect. There was
And you know, and that was the point when I definitely, I think, really, literally disconnected from myself somehow. I found this coping mechanism, which was fantasy.
Sure.
And I stayed there for a little while, and then my real father showed up when I was about 11. I came from school one afternoon, and my real father was sitting. And now my mother had a few boyfriends in between, kind of, you know, whatever. And so this guy was sitting in the kitchen, and my mother said, "You know, this is." And I said, "No." And she said, "This is Len, and he's your father." And I was, it just blew my mind. Like, so wait a minute. All that stuff.
Who'd we bury?
Yeah.
Exactly. Who is that dude? Could, you know, so.
That's such a head trip for an 11-year-old.
Yeah.
Lost a father to feel disconnected and to hear.
I mean, and there's lots of.
And what do you do? Were you like, "Hey, nice to meet you, Dad"?
No, not really. I was a little bit. I mean, first of all, I was kind of. He was this, like, he was a big guy. And he had, like, jet black hair. I remember that. And it sort of swept back. And he had a lot of tattoos. And all these gaudy rings. Just very much like me. and cheap gold jewelry. Like, what we used to call market boy jewelry. And I thought, yeah, it probably is my dad. You know, but he came back a couple of times and took me and my sister out. And you know, and I think it was explained to me at that point then the reason why I wasn't told was I was too young and we didn't – he was out of the picture. My real father, who just lived 30 minutes away, was out of the picture because at that time – we didn't want to be a family where this guy kept showing up and
it was like scandalous.
But I mean, it was like my mum did it too as well. She felt like she was protecting me, but I was the type of kid I needed to know stuff. You know, I needed to be told. I remember once hearing my mum say to a neighbor across the fence, like, "You know, David needs a lot of love." You know, out of all the kids. And I remember thinking, what does that mean? You know?
Do you think that's true?
I think it's kind of true, and I used it to my advantage by joining a band.
Right.
And, you know, and get being liked by people. And
That never goes away.
I know. It's kind of, it is very, it's a real cliche, really, all of it. But, the truth is, I kind of had a lot of mates that grew up like that as well. It was sort of, we grew up on like council estates in Essex, and it was, you know, it was very difficult for my mom. You know, I think she had a really hard time raising 4 kids.
Oh, my God, of course.
She had a couple of jobs. Everything we had was rented. You know, it was like sometimes the carpet disappeared. You know, the rug in the living room would be like, oh, because it wasn't paid for or something.
Right.
The television, everything we had was rented. But my mother, like, really took good care of us. I mean, She really did. She did the best she could. But, I mean, amazing. Like, when I think about it now, how hard it is, you know, it's just, that's the hardest job in the world for a mother to raise children. It's just the hardest job in the world.
And also, reading that that you loved getting in trouble, like, legitimately.
I did. I sought it out. I gravitated to any little gang of guys that looked like they were trouble. And I wasn't really a bad kid, but I got into a lot of trouble. By the time I was 15, I'd been in attendance centre. I'd been up in juvenile court like 3 or 4 times for vandalism, driving and taking away, more vandalism. It was pretty easy, though, where I lived, to get arrested. You know, it was like, you know, you didn't have to do much, really. And like I said, you know, it'd be the kind of, it's the kind of town that, like, if I was walking down a street with a couple of my mates, like, a cop car would roll up on you and the window would go down and go, "Where are you going, David?" You know, it was that
first
kind
name
of,
basis,
you know, like, yeah, where are you going? I'm just going home. Did you guys take a car from someone? No. Well, it has your fingerprints all over it. You know, it was that kind of thing. Or my mother would, this is what I'd hear as well, there'd be a knock at the door. Or my mum would come in the living room and I'd be watching TV and she'd be like, "Did you get in trouble? Did you do something?" And I was to be like, "Why?" She said, "Well, there's a police car just pulled up outside." And I said, "Yeah, I did." And she said, "Who with?" And I'd say, "So-and-so, a couple of my mates. We stole a car on the way home from school." Okay. And then my mum would like, go to the front door.
When
there was this was a policeman. "Hello, is David home?" You know, and she'd be like, "Well, yes, why?" And she'd be, "Well, we need to talk to him about it." "Well, he's been here for..." She'd just lie.
Oh, that's
she would,
so sweet.
She would just lie, and I'd hear her lying, and then, you know, she'd finally give in. And, yeah, so that ended... To be honest, all that stuff ended for me because of music, really. I realised it was going nowhere. I wasn't that stupid. Some of my friends were getting in, like, they'd stepped it up a bit.
Right.
You know, they were, like, going to rob the post office or something. You know what I mean? And I was, you know, it was like, there was only one little post office in town, and, like, a balaclava over the head was not going to...
You're like, "You guys already know us by
our
names."
Yeah, you'd go in there and it'd be like Mrs. Jones from next door. She'd be like, "David, just go."
"Who is this David person?"
Yeah, no, I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm Devin.
It was a bit like that. It's like, so I kind of was lucky. I kind of found a group of friends that were going up to the East End of London and were going to see some bands and... Bands like Susie and the Band, She's in the Damned, and 999, and all these, you know, The Clash, and they're playing all these little pubs and clubs, Hope and Anchor, Music Machine, and, you know, all these kind of places, the Electric Ballroom. And so I tagged along with them. And when I first saw Dave Vanium up there on stage, that was like, "I'm going to do that," you know.
God,
it was
it.
Like, it wasn't anything about the way he was singing or the music, really. Oh, I love The Damned. I mean, it was my first real love, but I was a member of the fan club. They sent me a rubber bat.
Oh,
But when I'd watched Dave Vanium, like, stalking the stage, and I was like, I can do that. I think I can black.
Did you know you could sing, though?
Yeah.
Not really. No. I mean, I was from a very young age singing along to Bowie and stuff. You know, I was, you know, my mum's broom in her bedroom, like in her long mirror. You know, I was that kid, definitely pretending to be someone else from a very young age.
Sure.
And when I got the memo that I could actually do it and blag my way into sort of bands, when they asked, "Can you sing?" I'd, of course, be, "Yeah." I just, and so I was in a bunch of different bands that amounted to nothing. The Vermin.
Great name, though.
Yeah, The Spurts.
Great name.
They didn't really amount to anything. And then eventually it sort of led to this... there was a terrible band called The French Look that were kind of sort of a bit sort of early Ultravoxy.
Right.
Very early Ultravoxy. And I wasn't really singing or anything. I was just really humping their gear around for them and stuff. But there was a guy in the band that wanted me to sing in a band. And it just so happened, one day we were rehearsing in his schoolroom, and in the schoolroom next door was Vince Clark and Martin Gore and Andrew Fletcher, and they were called Composition of Sound. And we, in the room next door, were doing a cover version of Heroes by David Bowie. And Vince overheard it, and so somehow he got hold of me. There was no cell phones or anything like that. So, you know, a couple of weeks later,
oi, David,
it was something like that over the garden fence. You know, was that you singing Heroes? And it was a bit like that. And I was, yeah, it was me.
Want to be in a band?
Yeah, it was pretty much that. And so he said, I said, you got any gigs? He lied. He said they had. I think they had like a school gig or something. So that was, I'm thinking, end of 1979, 80, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's when, because I'll watch a lot of like, I'll go down these YouTube rabbit holes of like old. Mm-hmm. It's like you're watching.
I do the same.
Do the same thing. It's like, oh, look at the Talking Heads in 1976, mm-hmm. or like Susie and the Banshees, and you see,
yeah.
And they're so.
I love the Banshees.
Amazing. Yeah. And but they all start. It's when you're watching the videos, you're like, oh, you can't really hear. You can't really make anything out. It's just loud and a lot of shouting.
It was bad. I'm sure it was. But I'm sure it was bad, just as we were as well. But
then it starts to form somehow.
Yeah,
but
I think even when it's bad, for me, it's so important. Because when it's bad, it gives you a, I can do that too. Watched The Damned, I'm sure they weren't that good, but you were like, I can do that
right.
too.
That's absolutely right. I mean, in 1978, I sneaked into the back of Earl's Call, where Bowie was playing, and with a couple of my mates, we promptly got thrown out. But I got caught enough of it to see. But that was just, Earl's Call was like this huge arena, which I think probably only held like maybe 8,000 people, but it was massive. You know, I'd never, and there was, Bowie was like just something else to me, out of this world, but gave me everything I needed at a very young age. I felt like that alien that he sang about.
Right.
And so he was, you know, that was my first love, but his music. But yeah, seeing Dave Vanium, seeing, I mean, Susie Sue was like scary. She was just like, oh my God. It was just, she just was everything that this young man wanted. Yes. You know, she was awesome and so powerful and, you know, really intimidating. If you locked eyes with her, oh boy, you could, it's just, you know.
Oh my God.
Darting all over the place, but she could just destroy you with her eyes. But I was lucky I got to see all these bands. I mean, because quite often in those days, like 78, 77, 78, there would be like three or four of these bands on the same bill. It would be like, you know, 999, Susie and the Banshees and the Damned, you know, The Clash and, you know, Susie and the Banshees. It was just, because then there was always somewhere to go. So I ended up like around that time as well. There was a squat in King's Cross in London. There was a lot of squats and it was full of punks. They took over this whole building and it was right around the corner of Music Machine. So I used to spend a lot of time up there for, it seemed like a long time, but it was probably just 6 months.
What was the energy in it? Like when you're going to see Susie and the Banshees and the Damned, like what is the venue size? What is the energy in the room? Does it feel like, oh, this is something special, or did it just feel like something really cool to do?
No, it was totally, it was like the thing to do for me. It was a part of a gang. I hung out with all these other punks.
Did you guys feel like you were on the ground floor of something that's like, this is going to be important?
Know it. You didn't know it. You know, too young to know. I mean, I was like 15.
Oh,
16,
gotcha.
You know, but I definitely was part of something that, you know, nobody else understood.
Right.
And we were like hunted down by people at that time as well. Like if you had different color hair. And you were a guy, and I had like, you know, I had purple hair, I had orange hair, I had white hair. You know, you chased home, literally, from like get off the train and the yobs would see you. You were literally chased all the way home. If they caught you, you'd get quite a beating just for the way you look, because you look so different. I mean, when I think about it today, it's crazy. But yeah, it was like you were a threat to normality.
Sure.
You know? Earring in my nose.
Totally.
But the fact that some people organized enough to go up. Because, I mean, you know.
No, it was like a movement. It was a movement, but it was small and it didn't last long, really. And, you know, a lot grew from that, but it really, I mean, it shone really brightly for at the most 2 years.
Oh my gosh.
You know, and then it suddenly, but then it, I was lucky, see, because then I got lucky enough to join this band. You know, I was 18. I was at art college, you know, as all dropouts do. I left school at 15. I was asked to leave school. More or less, Easter.
That's very British. We were asked to leave school.
I was asked, like, exactly. By the deputy headmaster, you know, gone. We wouldn't mind if you didn't come back after. Like, you know, I was like, all right, Ed.
It would be very polite.
We wouldn't
miss you if you didn't come back. It was something like that. And I was like, well, I ain't coming back.
Fine, we could use the space. Excellent.
Great. Good. Off you go then.
More lunches for everyone else.
Good luck out there, you loser.
Well, that's, you know, when Depeche Mode became one of the biggest bands in the history of music, were all those people like, I always knew,
no, definitely not. In fact, I went back to Mr. Allen, you know, years later and told him, I went back to the school and I said, Mr. Allen, you know, I knocked on the deputy heads up and I was probably 19, 20 and, you know, made a few quid. Don't know, maybe bought my first like XR3i or something.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you know, like pulled into the school next to his little Renault 2CV, his teacher car, and told him. I was like, remember when you said I would amount to nothing? I said, well, I'm something. Like, I was on Top of the Pops.
But he must have known that because there were only like three shows on
it. I don't know, but it was, I got immense satisfaction out of doing that. I think I was at school when corporal punishment still existed. So this guy caned me so many times.
Oh my God.
I mean, whipped me, you know, literally. Like, you'd get six of the best, go to his office, you know, bend over the desk. Literally, and you know, that, like you see in these old films, that's what we got.
Did some of the undercurrent of S&M come from that?
I think he definitely enjoyed it. That's for sure.
We
enjoyed pretending it didn't hurt. I mean, my friend and I, Mark, who would often end up in the office, we would do our utmost to just give him a look like that's all you got.
Yeah, like I don't even yeah, totally.
Yeah. And then you'd go into the bathroom, into the toilet, and literally pull down your train, and there'd be like bloody wheels.
Oh my God.
It was brutal. I mean, and the worst one though was a wooden ruler across the knuckles.
Oh Jesus.
Yes. Like when they hold out your hand and just whack it across. So it was a little while after I left school that was outruled, I think, and in England it was like,
which is too bad because you realize how well it worked.
My mother used
100 million albums worldwide. Don't lie, Dave.
It certainly made
you ripped you into shape.
I used to go home and say, "Mom, you know, Mr. I didn't really do it." She said, "Well, you probably deserved it." Yeah, it was that's about what I got from my mom. But
I remember being in high school, and I went to all boys Catholic school, and there was this guy who would tour. This was probably 87. There was a guy who would tour around all the like the Catholic schools, I guess, and he had a list of songs called the Dirty Dozen.
Oh, nice.
Do you know what that? Do you remember that at all? Do you remember what that was?
I mean, it sounds vaguely familiar.
Like,
where it was like,
these are songs that are negatively influencing your kids.
Yes.
And all the songs were fucking great, by the way. Yeah. I feel like
this
it was
a list
just,
of my favorite songs.
I was like, why are they? They're just advertising great songs to kids. But there was a Depeche Mode song on there.
Yeah, it's probably like Master
and Servant.
Servant.
Yeah.
It was we got a lot of stick for that song. It was, we didn't really get it. I mean, the video was pretty, you know, masochistic, I guess. We were all kind of chained up and being like pulled around. We did the video in Berlin, I remember, and it was pretty bizarre, actually, now I think about it. But, you know, that was, we were odd guys. You know, we were all odd, and it was lucky that we found each other. We definitely were weird. You know, we liked Iggy and the Stooges, and it was stuff that we liked. Martin was a bit more like, he was also already heavily influenced by Kraftwerk, and he was this, but we both had Bowie in common, particularly Heroes, Low, Station to Station, but Ziggy Stardust by far was like our I'm sure Martin learned how to play guitar to that album, probably.
Are you looking at other bands coming up at the time? Are you looking over at, like, The Cure or Joy Division? Look at these guys and go, no, they're doing this, so we should do this.
The Joy Division, for sure. I mean, I recently rebought a lot of vinyl by Joy Division.
Yep.
And I played a couple of albums, and I was just like, this is so heavy.
Yeah.
You know, they are so dark. But at the time, I was just, it spoke to me, you know.
Of course.
Just like,
tortured teenager.
Oh, yeah. It was awesome. But now it's just the angst just in Ian Curtis's voice is, it gives me goosebumps. I mean, I love that, anything like that. I mean, to this day, my voice that speaks to me the most is probably Mark Lanigan's. You know, it's like, I listen because he's a singer. He's a real singer. There's plenty of vocalists out there, but like, there's few singers. Johnny Cash, like people that you listen to, Bowie, like where you believe them. Billie Holiday, like that's what I gravitate to. If I believe the singer, I'm all in.
Yeah.
You know, I'm all in. So,
but it's amazing that you were able to navigate the, because it would have been very easy to just have been an 80s band. But
yeah,
then when I was in college, I remember we played in my roommates and I don't know, for whatever reason, we had a ritual every morning. We would play World in My Eyes. Like in the first thing in the morning, like to get everyone up.
Yeah.
Just that, and I would always hear that. And I would know it was time to wake up. And every morning that song, like, so you guys, you were able to basically be timeless. And so how do you, I mean, maybe this is an impossible question to answer. How do you do that? How do you keep,
We never wanted to. We didn't fit in with a lot of the groups that sort of came up the same time as us. We definitely felt like we had much more in common with The Cure than, say, at the time, like Duran Duran or whatever.
Right.
You know, the other bands that were having great success, to be honest, at that time. We kind of, we were having success, but we weren't like, we definitely weren't mainstream. Not even in England. In fact, the more we kind of were pushed in that direction, the weirder we got. And I don't know if that was something. I remember there was one point about 1986 when a radio plugger that we used at the time came and listened to some stuff we were doing. I think we were recording at the time Black Celebration. So we had maybe recorded Stripped. I don't know. Anyway, we played him a couple of songs. And his face was just like, I'm never going to get this on the radio. And we were just like, yes. Like, we enjoyed that, that we were not, it was going to be a struggle. I mean, he managed to somehow get us on the radio a bit, but we definitely were heading in a different direction. We were performing more. We certainly were a band that was, we were touring a lot in Europe. And we'd been to the States a few times, and we realized that we were creating like a cult following.
Right.
That was way more important to us than being on the radio.
Right.
It really was. There was pressure for us to be on the radio because, you know, we'd signed a record deal over here with Sire Records, Warner Brothers, and they just did not get us at all. We'd come to the end of a tour when we had played to maybe 300,000 people in America, and the record company would be like, why have we only sold 100,000 albums? Like, we'd be at this board meeting up at Warner Brothers there in Burbank, wherever it was.
Right.
And we'd sitting around and be all like, Howie, Lenny. And we'd just be like, wait, you played to 300,000 people? Why aren't we selling more records? That wouldn't be the question we'd be asking. We kind of already had this idea that we were doing something on our own. With that was more important somehow,
and that's how you stayed in
prison. Yeah, I think so. I think, and then we had some moments later on where we had some great radio success just by accident. I think it was just right place, right time.
Was that personal Jesus?
You know, yeah, Joy to Silence, Policy of Truth. There were certain songs that were still, to be honest, quite weird, and then Songs of Faith and Devotion. We purposely sort of went in to make an album that was nothing like Violator. You know, we wanted to I mean, Flood, who was produced by later and had been incredibly successful all over the world. Back in the days when you sold a lot of records, I think that album sold, you know, some 12 million copies or something around the world, maybe more than that. I don't know. But we wanted to go, when we go back into the studio, we did not want to make Violator 2. Of course, there was a lot of pressure to do that.
Of course.
But we just knew that it was not the right move. And this is not something that Depeche Mode, we don't sit around having talks about this stuff. I think that we're still pretty odd, we're pretty indifferent, and that's kind of what makes it interesting. When we go in the studio, it's still weird. We don't all, hey guys, what's up? Let's rock and roll. You know, it's just not. It's weird and it's dark and it's sometimes heavy and. And then we make this music that comes out of that.
But I think that's the perfect answer, because if you're driven by the money or if you're driven by the fame or any of the success part, then once you get that, then I feel like people go, well, now what do we do? Well,
And we had those moments, definitely. I definitely personally had those moments, like when I moved out here to LA and, you know, just reached a point of like, what do we do? We played that the Rose Bowl and, you know, what do we do now? Like, what do we do now? So I just dove into debauchery, you know, and found that was very, it was a big cliche, but at the same time, it was so like somewhere I needed to go, because I don't know, I wanted to sort of destroy what was happening somehow.
Because it was too good, or feel like you deserved it?
I think a bit of both. I think, I wanted to just experience that, and at the same time, and once I was really experiencing that, I didn't know how to get out.
Yeah,
it was impossible.
It's kind of interesting. It's almost like
impossible to get out.
It's almost like you were.
It was the hardest thing I ever did.
Vandalizing yourself.
Yeah, I was. I'm very much into self-inflicted pain. That's for sure.
Sure.
And I've sort of. I'm just the difference today is like. I'm very aware of that I can go to really dark spaces and I kind of catch myself. Like, I mean, this happens on a daily basis. You know? it's not like, you know, I can be in the greatest of moods and then just sink into oblivion. And it's, you know, it's just the way I am. I'm also very aware of the fact that I'm incredibly fortunate to have the choice and the option to choose like what I do, where I go, who I work with. It still blows my mind. I'm still that, a part of me is still that kid from Essex, kind of just blag my way into anything and then get out of it, you know. So
how did you get out of it? Because there were so many. Just to read the accounts, it's like there were so many times where I was like, how's he going to get out of that? Oh, he survived.
Yeah. I was lucky I had a lot of hostages.
<You know? laughs> Emotional hostages.
Yeah. There was a lot of people around me that it was in their best interest, first of all, to keep me alive.
Sure.
And then secondly, I'm just... there's just something bigger. That's all I can say. It's like a bigger thing that somehow pulls me out of these terrible choices I get myself into sometimes. I'm just that kind of person. I'm drawn, you know, and I'm drawn to that kind of comedy. I'm drawn to, you know, the Louis C.K.'s, the Bill Burr's,
yeah.
You know, Mark Maron's, you know, and I love comedy, movies, music, whatever. I'm drawn to the stuff that, you know, takes you to those places.
Yeah, when I met you at K-Rock and you go, oh, hey, I know your show at midnight. I was like, you do?
Yeah, exactly.
How do you know that?
Dude, I'm going to rat out Hardwick, too, because he texted me and was like, Dave Gahan knows who I am.
Yeah, I feel his pain. And I think that's part of what, you know, Martin and I, over the years with Depeche as well. It's like the people that are drawn to our music and what we do, it's like we're all a little odd.
Sure.
And there was at times when it's like you didn't have a gang to be odd with, And so we created this huge gang, which is, you know, the following of Depeche Mode.
Well,
know?
Yeah.
Can I ask some dorky questions really fast?
Yeah, sure.
Only because when we were talking about earlier, first of all, because 1979 to me is the greatest year of music, period. And I'm so fascinated. I've read so many books about that two-year period you're talking about where it only lasted that long where you're hanging out watching Susie and the Banshees, but everything cool came from that.
There was, I mean, it went into The Cure and Echo and the Bunnymen, and like there were these sort of bands that and Joy Division, and, you know, I feel very fortunate that, you know, I had that. I had that experience, and I was part of that. And
well, that's what I was curious about is you, because you mentioned The Cure and stuff, like, do you see them, and even especially at the time, as rivals? Or were you like, I like them we want to...
definitely not rivals. I mean...
I'm always curious as to all the bands I like, if they see everyone else's competition or if you, like, listen to Cure records.
We would follow... I mean, I would, you know, Violator, then there was Disintegration. There was, like, certain records, and it was like, I couldn't wait for the next record kind of thing to see what they were going to... And when they put out Disintegration, it was more like, wow, this is so good.
You know, really?
Yeah, definitely. It was so good. I mean, it was just... so dark and so gothic and so good. And so, no, I definitely admired that stuff more. And then really around that time, that's when I went back to, I listened to a lot of Bowie, and I still do. Uh-huh. Low and Station to Station and Heroes and those records in particular, Joy Division. And I was not listening to anything that was on the radio.
Well, I think that you guys kind of invented, it's like Chris was saying, being timeless. I feel like you guys were always ahead of the curve because, like, okay, my two favorite genres of music are post-punk and when people were first figuring out how to use synthesizers. And I think you guys are on the cusp of that.
We were definitely trying to figure it out.
Totally.
The only reason, really we first used synthesizers more than traditional instruments. I mean, Fletch played bass originally. I used to work the little drum machine. I think Vince played some guitar and he had a synthesizer, and Martin had a synthesizer. And the reason was they were more interesting. You could create more interesting sounds, and we weren't great musicians. So you couldn't we couldn't make these other instruments interesting. And I think the electronics kind of gave us that edge to explore. And we were still writing in very traditional sort of pop music way. You know, it was still the same as The Cure and all these bands. It was in a certain way, but you had to have a sound. One thing I can say for all those bands at that time, whether it was the Bunnymen or it was The Cure or it was us or whatever, that we were all really different. Like, you couldn't really, like, we were, you could group us in, you could play us on the radio side by side, but every band really had their own identity. I can't, when I listen to Radio Neff, I'm just going, like, everything seems to just, like, maybe I'm just like this old fart, like, and I don't, you know, but I can't, the only thing I really gravitate to is a lot of, like, rap music, to be honest, like, a lot of stuff that I find is really, I mean, some stuff, like, I mean, of course, not all of it, same as anything else, but rhythmically and in a punky way, it's like modern blues or something.
Or fucking with... I mean, it's just that idea of, like, fucking with whatever the system is.
I think so. I think there's something about it that I find is really ballsy and...
Well, also with rap, so much of it hinges on the personality and the story of whoever the lead guy, like, whoever... If it's just one guy...
Yeah, there's real,
like,
characters.
It's his story, his... You know, it is. Yeah. It's character and story, and you know, if he's telling an authentic story, then, like you said, you know when someone means it.
But that happened, I guess that happened in New York, and you know, there was all this mainstream disco, and then all of a sudden in the Bronx and in Brooklyn and these places, there was these underground parties going on where people were, like, scratching and doing things that were interesting with disco records.
Right.
But breaking them up and making break beats and doing stuff and creating, like, you know, human drum machines. So I think for us it was always more interesting to work with, like, electronics like that and mix it up with stuff, but also to find people to work with that were really interested in that too. They were interested in that were new, innovative, that weren't necessarily conditioned to the traditional forms of recording. We were lucky to find people who found us, mostly through Daniel Miller from Mute Records, who introduced us to these different engineers and different producers that were not the norm. And they would find interesting ways. I mean, the first thing we would go when we went into a recording studio was we'd go in the kitchen to see what things we could bash and throw down the stairs. And,
totally.
And you know, that made noises that were interesting. Then in those days, you had to record on a tape machine. You'd record something that was just, you know, throwing a bunch of pots and pans down the stairs. You know, for instance, set up a couple of mics and you record these things and then loop that piece of tape and create, which became the beginning of, say, Blasphemous Rumours. You know, it was just a bunch of pots and pans falling down the stairs, but suddenly there's a sound that nobody had heard before. I don't even know if we were that aware of what we were doing, but we were a bit wacky, you know.
Yes.
And
but that's the most appealing part of it to me, because I feel like at that time it was like you guys and Human League and like maybe New Order.
Let's not forget the Human League. They were really
inventing a genre.
Yeah, New Order. I mean, definitely there was. Yeah, and we were all very different.
But I like that it's sort of, you're listening going, these dudes are figuring it out as the, it's still amazing,
no, totally.
But it's like,
we
tell the enthusiasm. You guys are like, let's figure out what sounds
this
makes.
We're still that. Yeah. I mean, in rehearsals, in the studio, everything, it's still trying to discover. We've got better at it, but it's still about trying to discover a way to make the music interesting sonically.
And that's the, as a listener, like, that's the most exciting thing to me. Well, that's the authenticity that I'm like, oh yeah, these guys are excited to make new stuff.
Well, I think it says a lot. I think when you can tell when a band covers something, like where their hearts are at, because sometimes it's like, you mentioned Echo and the Bunnymen, they cover People Are Strange, but it was basically just like, well, you just covered it like The Door. You just basically did a karaoke version.
Right.
I mean, like, it was just them going, I wonder if we could sound exactly like yours. But then you guys cover Route 66, and it's just, and now I think a lot of people now probably don't even remember what the original sounds like, because that was such a fucking enormous hit song.
Yeah, which was totally, we used to do these things, and it was by accident, really. I think it was the B-side of Behind the Wheel, which was from that album, and I think over here they flipped it over on the radio and started playing Roots, that version of Route 66, which was, to us, was like a real throwaway thing that we had recorded probably in a couple of hours and threw it down because we needed a B-side, you know.
Right.
But it became, I mean, we did it live, and it became part of that Music for the Masses show. It was a big part of that show. But
I mean, it's, how do you
I don't think we were even aware that much of that it was a cover, you know, of the original version. But we were trying to work out the chords or something that sounded similar, and then get a beat going. It was about getting a beat going in the studio. And that's what I was identifying with a lot of the rap stuff, because it's about a beat. And back then, it was really, for us, about finding a really interesting rhythm track, a beat, made up of noises that weren't necessarily that tuneful. In fact, you know, quite often on some of those albums that we did, the sounds are pretty kind of like, what? Like, they kind of, but that's...
I love that.
Yeah.
You know,
what's great about it, too, is that talking to you and understanding some of your struggles and hearing about the music, it's the same. It's a reflection of what your life has been, which is essentially figuring out how to contain and control the chaos.
Yeah, and I'm still doing that. Like I said, the beast, you know, as it gets, you know, I can tame it a little, but it's definitely just it's in me. It's there. I have a great talent in being able to destroy. That's the way I perform on stage as well. I treat the stage with a lot of disdain. I enjoy that. Why is this happening? You know, it's like, I have a lot of fun with it. My tongue is kind of firmly planted in my cheek, but at the same time, I really go there with the songs. Like, the songs, and now when we've been rehearsing for this tour, They span such a long period of time. Different songs like In Your Room or Walking in My Shoes, or they represent a real period in my life. And I really go back there. It's like it all comes flooding back in that 3 or 4 minutes, like certain scenes and scenarios, you know. I don't know, just...
Is there anything you guys don't want to play or that you just refuse to...
There's a few songs. I mean, Martin particularly hates People Are People.
That's which, so funny that you would hate that song.
Yeah, right, which was a big hit and would fit quite nicely into the scheme of things.
Oh, God, can I please... How weird was it that you guys had to be like, oh, we're not a white power band?
Yeah, my God, yeah.
How weird? Did you ever think you were going to have to say that?
I have had to answer so many questions about that in weird ways, but
well, I just remember
it was just so ridiculous.
It's so, remember when Johnny Marr told David Cameron, he was like, "You're not allowed to like the Smiths."
Yeah, exactly.
It reminded me of that, where it's like, "Dude, you're not allowed to like
Someone
us."
Someone actually commented on that. Someone said something. I drew that analogy. I thought that was a really good analogy, but it's absolutely true. It's like, have you listened to our music?
Yes!
Like everything about it is like just the opposite of what you're looking for.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, that's what's so... I mean, you know, when you... As you're developing... I mean, the only analogy I have is comedy. When I think like, oh, I'm going to perform jokes I did 20 years ago, I shudder and I go, those were terrible. I couldn't...
There's certain songs you can... Like, on the last tour, we threw Just Can't Get Enough in there again. And as an encore, and in a certain place after a certain bunch of songs have been done, you can come on stage again and then have some fun with that and kind of go there. But it has to really fit. You know, you got to do it with gusto. You can't, you know, you got to have fun with it. So there's certain things that you just can't, you try them and they don't quite work. So, yeah, it's the same, I would imagine, of like old jokes or things that you did. There's certain things that you hear now and you're just like, what? it's even like my voice, like on certain things when I was like, you know, 10 years old or whatever, however young I was, I sound like that. And to me, I'm like, oh, God, I can't sing that melody. It doesn't work for me anymore.
But you have is there anything that you look back on now and you go, oh, I have a fresh perspective on this old thing, and now it means something different, and so it has this renewed meaning?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've been rehearsing a few songs this time that we haven't done for a lot of years, and there's certain ones, Everything Counts, for instance. It fits right in now, and it fits right in with everything, all the other songs that are on this new record, Spirit. So, you know, yeah, it's... I'm sorry, I got really distracted by your wallpaper.
By the amazing Star Wars wallpaper? The fuzzy Star Wars wallpaper?
I just completely zoned out. I was like, oh, it's so cool.
It's so hypnotic. And it's fuzzy. You can rub on it.
Oh, well,
it's
I will do
too.
That before I leave.
Yeah, you can definitely rub the wallpaper. But I also... what is the feeling like? So you go on stage and you know you play for, I don't know, probably
a couple of hours. Yeah.
And you're taking and you're really kind of living through all these emotional periods for all these songs. And there's, you know, 50,000 people or however many people it is. And then you walk backstage and it's just like, now what happens?
It's a bit like that. Although I tend to disappear. I just... I get out of there as quick as possible and get to a room where I can just sit and stare at the wall for 4 hours. You know, that's kind of what I do. I just I feel so in the thing that I can't really talk about it afterwards.
Right.
Really. It's just, and I do go through such a gambit of emotions that I just literally am done. I get in the van, I go back to the hotel, you know, sit in an ice bath, you know? and just try and get the feeling back in my legs. Nowadays, and that's pretty much it. You know, order room service and stare at the wall, eating French fries. But you know, I don't even know how I had the energy all those years of what we used to get up to after the show.
Right.
I mean, the show was just like this little part of it. And then the whole evening just went into the next morning, wherever that was, every night, everywhere, for many, many years.
Well, you're Wolverine when you're younger. I mean, yes. you can just sort of be like, yeah, dust it, off it and go, true. Okay.
You pull into McDonald's or whatever after it's in the bus, and then happy meal and good to go. that doesn't work anymore.
No, but, now you have to worry about things like cholesterol.
Oh, my God. It's just being able to walk.
Well, it's, you know, like to be able to be a band for a few decades and still be able to do a full show requires a lot.
It does.
It's work.
I know. I enjoy that. You know, I enjoy that. I enjoy the challenge of that. And there's nothing quite like it. Can't explain it. It's the weirdest thing. Those couple of hours on stage are the only part of it that makes any sense whatsoever. The rest of it, the traveling, it's for those 2 hours. I mean, I think Charlie Watts from the Rolling Stones said it best once. He said, you know, when he was asked about what it was like being in the Stones for 30 years, he said, well, 5 years of working, 25 years of waiting.
you're always just waiting.
Like, that is awesome.
You're on a bus, or you're on a plane, or you're waiting to go on stage.
And then you do your thing for couple of hours on stage.
I mean, it's interesting that because earlier you sort of hinted at, like, listen, I know I'm very lucky, I can do what, you know, I have all these options, and I do think it's for
and
most.
I really today I feel fortunate that I am very appreciative of that. I you know, I literally thank things all day long.
Yeah,
I went through many, many years not doing that. Not because I wasn't appreciative, but just I just was on full steam go to try and get somewhere. I don't know. I don't know where that is.
Were you running to or away from?
Bit of both. Definitely trying to prove something.
Did you ever prove it?
I think to other people. And then finding that didn't really satisfy the need at all. And then over the last, like, I would say 10 years, kind of just feeling like, wow, I did all right.
Well,
I think you're pretty cool, so I don't know if that helps.
I did all right. And like, my
I think
kids
I solved
like
your problem.
Me, you know,
yeah.
My wife likes me. That's still like a bit weird for me. The self-loathing is still there if I want to go there.
Well, yeah, but that's what's up. So when people go, what do you got to worry about? You got all the money in the world.
I know,
and then you go,
I know.
You have to understand that the reason people become artists is because they suffer in some way, mostly, and that's defensive armor. So they either become comedians or musicians because they're trying to understand themselves.
What I really identify with comedians, it's the ones that I sort of grew up with as well, because that self-loathing and that kind of, but then being able to, that genius of being able to turn that into comedy. I mean, I've been in like shows, I mean, I've been in shows with comedians where I like, or a movie where I burst out laughing and it's someone just like killed themselves or something. You know, and everybody else is like, and then I suddenly like,
catch yourself
into my chair, you know, like, because I have this weird sense of humor.
Well, the darkness never goes away because it's defensive. It's protective.
Yeah, I think so. And so I find that it's like, I remember years and years ago, I went to this rehab, and this guy, this counselor, said to me, he took me over to this. It was one of these fancy rehabs, and there was horses. And he took me over to these horses, and he said, "I want you to walk into the horses and."
This is crazy. What I think about. This is
walking to the horses, yeah. And one of them's going to pick you. And I was like, dude, I don't think this is a good idea. You know,
let the horse choose
like,
you.
Let the horse choose you. And I was like, oh my God. So I stand there. These horses start sniffing around. I'm not very happy. I'm like sweating. I've just got to this place. I'm like detoxing. It was somewhere in Arizona. I'm like, who put me here? You know, and this horse came over to me, and it stomped on my foot. Like, and I had these little, Converse shoes on with no socks, you know, kind of no laces or anything.
I'm barely like, not sure.
It totally stomped on my foot and drew blood, you know. And I started laughing. I just burst out laughing. And this counselor looked at me dead straight, and he just, deadpan, was like, David, your pain is not funny. And I was just like... No, it really is. You know, dude, that was... You told me to do that. You know, it was just... I didn't get it at all, but... it stuck with me that. Like, your pain is not funny. Like, later on, maybe 5 years later, when I was sitting in some hotel room, like, you know, with the crack pipe, like, shaking, I was like, my pain is not funny. You know, it was like, it came back to me. You know?
But you, I mean, it is, because you went through a lot of really horrible things.
Yeah, well, self-inflicted. I got to say, like, all that stuff, I'm very lucky to come out the other side of it. A lot of people don't. I was lucky because there was those people putting me in these rehabs and taking care of me and trying, but I was often trying to escape something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I found myself in those places. That's why drink and drugs was, you know, when it worked, it was the answer to everything. I mean, I felt great. I loved it. I loved drugs. I loved booze, you know, until it just didn't work anymore.
Right.
That's the awful moment when, you know, those years that you spend trying to make it work and it's just not.
There's no place left to escape to.
It was terrifying.
Except for the ultimate escape.
And then rehabs and stuff like that. That was just like not my idea of fun. It reminded me of going back to like those places that I was sent to as a kid, like attendance center and just juvenile courts and just, you know, you've got to get right. But I'm not right. You know?
Right.
Probably never will be. And I think the real key to all that stuff is, and I was lucky, was you do have to accept who you are and how you feel. And that it's okay. You don't have to medicate. You just, you know.
Sometimes you feel like shit.
Sometimes you feel like shit. And you've got to find people that also feel like shit. and you kind of, you know, it's not like you have to wallow in your own pain. But, like, you know, you've got to somehow find a place where you can find it amusing. Comedy helped me. Always did. Monty Python, whatever it was, it helped me.
Well, in all comedy, there is a seed of something horrible.
Yeah.
Because it's
good comedy.
Good comedy, yeah. Because there's something, it's protective and it helps us commune,
yeah.
And it helps us cope.
It's got to rub you the wrong way a little bit too, I think.
And so were you, when you would get to the brink of death and get brought back and come through it, would you wake up and go, ha 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 ha, or would you go, ah, shit?
I did both, but most of the time it was like I was pretty happy to kind of feel good again.
Oh, good.
Like, just feel, like, good about myself or whatever, like, healthy or whatever for a bit until the next time. But, that was a long process.
Well, I'm glad that you...
Thank you.
Because you're such
a
sweet, wonderful guy, and it was so wonderful to meet you at K-Rock, and I don't know if I mentioned to you about coming on the podcast at the time, but of course it was in the back of my head.
I think we said we'd get to get you. I think you might have mentioned it.
I think I might have mentioned it.
You know, brought it up.
I'm so glad you did.
Yeah. So, well, thanks for having me.
I am so absolutely pleased and honored. And I had April come on because April is like, April knows more about music than anyone, and I know quite a bit, but April,
I'm Hardwick's
like,
coolest friend, no big deal,
she says in her Gang of Four t-shirts.
I mean, whatever, guys. Yeah, of course.
How long did you spend picking out which t-shirt you were gonna wear today?
I saw that.
Not really that. I was like, it'd be in bad taste.
You've got plenty of those shirts, haven't you?
A whole wardrobe of them. So I was super excited to come hang out, for sure. And I'm always interested. I'm glad to hear you say, this is gonna be the dorkiest thing anyone's ever said, but I tend to feel bad. I'm like, I feel bad because you can't listen to Depeche Mode. Like, do you know what I mean? Because like,
you can't hear it.
You can't listen to your own band and be like, this is so great.
And it's funny you say that because people, I never listen to my band. I mean,
like,
because when
you
work on it, you do the thing. I mean, I actually only ever listen to a record that we've done before when we're making a new one.
Right.
And I sort of will reference. But
you can't, like, objectively.
No, and I kind of go, wow, it's. We really did that different, you know. So yeah, and then once we're performing, that's almost like a different band,
right?
Again, it's like another thing.
But it's cool to me to hear that you don't see other. I always think of my favorite. I'm like, oh, do they see them as rivals or are they like competition? But it's cool to think of you being like, no, I listen to the Cure.
That's also how innovation works. When you're open to. I think there is a healthy form of competition, which is not I must destroy everyone to succeed. It's, oh, they're doing that, so we should do this. And, this is like, that's how innovation drives.
There was definitely that, certainly in the 80s with certain bands, like around that time. it just they kind of lifted the bar, and you were like, "This is we're in with this group. This is our gang, not this other thing that people kind of." And I think that was what was odd about us was always that people never could quite put us in like a category. And so we weren't rock and we weren't pop.
You were just Depeche Mode.
Totally.
We were Depeche Mode, yeah.
I like, swear to God, I have never met a single person in my life who didn't like Depeche Mode. And I'm talking about people who like rap, punks, metal dudes, because right. I've worked in a bunch of record stores right. and stuff too. And you guys are like the Tom Hanks of bands.
Right.
Where it's like, no one
that's
doesn't
cool.
like
I'll
you.
Take that. I'll
no
take
one
that.
Doesn't like you.
I'll
well,
take that.
Thank you so much for being here, Dave Gahan.
Thanks.
And you can come back whenever you want. Spirit is the album, and you're about to do a massive tour.
Yes, we are. We are. We set off. Actually, we're doing some. We're actually doing a little show on Wednesday night at the Masonic Hollywood Forever.
Nice. Thanks.
Just
no.
for an hour, yeah.
What?
So maybe we can hook you guys up.
I mean,
maybe.
So. It's just like a half show. We're doing like maybe an hour or something like that, but it'd be fun.
I think we could be there for.
Yeah, that would be cool.
I'll clear my schedule.
Okay. And then we're off to Sweden. We're literally the next day. We start in Stockholm next week. And we're doing all these huge stadiums across Europe first, and then we do North America in the we call the fall.
All the dates are DepecheMode.com.
Yes.
You're welcome to come back anytime you want. Spirit is a new album, and thanks for being here today.
Yeah,
it was
thanks
an absolute pleasure. Cheers.
Thank you very
Enjoy
much.
Your burrito,
of
everyone.
Of course.
Thank you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Silicon Valley Season 4, now airing Sundays, 10 p.m. on HBO, or you can watch on the HBO Go or HBO Now app. Changes in the air, the Pied Piper guys pursue their video chat app, Piper Chat. This season, one of the best sitcoms. Why, is it really even a sitcom? It is a situational comedy. One of the best comedies in the history of television, I think. Silicon Valley, HBO, watch it.